Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
A couple of years ago, a cop was shot dead on a deserted pier in the tiny nation of Belize. The only other person there that night was a frightened young woman found covered in blood. By all appearances, it was an open and shut case. But not in Belize, where this woman was connected to a mysterious billionaire who basically runs the place.
Justice will not be served in this case. She's going to get away with it.
Or will she? White Devil. A Campside Media original. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures, and it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty and a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. Jeremy Clausus, founder and editor of The Sprawl, joining me from Calgary. Hello.
How are you, Jesse?
I'm doing great. Jeremy, today we are going to talk about Canada's best-funded digital media startup. It's a shit-posting propaganda hose funded by the government of Alberta.
I'm jealous.
Also, we will talk about the journalistic issues that can arise when you're reporting about things that you are purposefully ignorant about. Wet'suwet'en continued. Glad to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jesse.
This episode of Shortcuts is brought to everybody by Lauren Galluli, Peter Vanderleek, Tara Sloan, Donald Heights, Crystal Breka, Hilary Eisen, Uday Srinivasan, and Roy.
This is Roy from Vancouver, and I'm happy to support Canada Land because it tells me things I didn't get from other media. I didn't know things were that bad in Thunder Bay. I didn't know that Canada had that many dynasties despite listening to Canadian news all my life. And because I do know that Canada has some of the most concentrated media ownership in the world, and it badly needs oversight. Canada Land's doing a good job of it. Keep it up.
Jeremy Clausus, founder and editor of The Sprawl, joining me from Calgary. Hello.
How are you, Jesse?
I'm doing great. Jeremy, today we are going to talk about Canada's best-funded digital media startup. It's a shit-posting propaganda hose funded by the government of Alberta.
I'm jealous.
Also, we will talk about the journalistic issues that can arise when you're reporting about things that you are purposefully ignorant about. Wet'suwet'en continued. Glad to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jesse.
This episode of Shortcuts is brought to everybody by Lauren Galluli, Peter Vanderleek, Tara Sloan, Donald Heights, Crystal Breka, Hilary Eisen, Uday Srinivasan, and Roy.
This is Roy from Vancouver, And I'm happy to support Canada Land because it tells me things I didn't get from other media. I didn't know things were that bad in Thunder Bay. I didn't know that Canada had that many dynasties despite listening to Canadian news all my life. And because I do know that Canada has some of the most concentrated media ownership in the world, and it badly needs oversight. Canada Land's doing a good job of it. Keep it up.
So, Jeremy, I think people by now might have heard of this war room that your premier, Jason Kenney, has set up to fight the globalist forces trying to misinform everybody about the ethical oil that we produce in Canada. We've had enough, and Albertans have had enough, of these lies being spread by these Soros-funded... I don't know if he said that. But he feels that there's a lot of negative anti-oil stuff out there, and so he's dedicated... I think it's $120 million over 4 years. That's what the Globe and Mail says. So $30 million a year to this war room to fight anti-oil sands messaging. $30 million a year. Jeremy, you run the sprawl. You got like 900 crowdfunding supporters for your local news outfit. What's your budget per year?
I wish it was comparable to that. Let's just say that. Yeah, it's a funny situation taking on these foreign-funded radicals, including most recently, the New York Times.
The New York Times. If I had $30 million to fight anti-oil sands propaganda and the New York Times ran some just scurrilous, just baseless slander of my beloved oil sands, such as this piece that recently ran, the headline was "Global Financial Giants Swear Off Funding an Especially Dirty Fuel." So, you know, meaning is comprised of words and, you know, global financial giants, they exist. They have sworn off funding. Yes, they have. An especially dirty fuel. Well, that's the part that I think that the worm didn't like. But I mean, it kind of is an especially dirty fuel. Anyhow, the worm didn't like that. And the war room, with their $30 million, has some pretty high-level tactics for fighting scurrilous information like that published by the New York Times. They like to kind of get down with the kids on social media and speak in kind of the vernacular of the internet. So what we had was a series of tweets from the Canadian Energy Center, which is the war room, trying to discredit the New York Times. The New York Times has had a beef with Alberta for some time now, says the Canadian Energy Center. They aren't the most dependable source. Oh, well, you're giving me food for thought there. Their track record is very dodgy, says the Canadian Energy Center of the New York Times. They have been accused of anti-Semitism countless times. Can't even count the number of times New York Times has been accused of anti-Semitism. And what else did they dig back to? They're like...
the Jason Blair scandal.
Jason Blair. Everybody remember Jason Blair? 20 years ago, there was a New York Times reporter who just made stuff up. Maybe there's a new Jason Blair.
And he wrote that article.
Maybe he wrote that article.
Exactly.
What else did they get to? They were like, the Times had like a problematic obit of Walter Cronkite that I think they very quickly and thoroughly corrected. But that was also thrown into this pile of reasons to not believe. Like, you've got the government of Alberta telling people to basically like, don't believe anything the New York Times says.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to take aim at the New York Times and go back, you know, 15 or 20 years, I was surprised they didn't include the weapons of mass destruction, Saddam Hussein stuff. Like, I mean, that's just sitting right there.
There's a lot of problems with any, I mean, you know, any news organization, even the New York Times has, you know, there's a history of corrections and problems and flaws. But, you know, it's just sort of like an organized government. Like, let's assault truth, you know, like a source of pretty high level journalism most of the time, because it's come into conflict in stating facts about the financial divestment and the cratering of the fossil fuel market. Like, it was a factual news piece. I don't think that the war room had anything to say calling into question any of the information in the Times piece.
No, they did do a piece after that did get into the piece. I mean, this is... the war room is, in its way, a thing of beauty. It's comedy. It's pure comedy. And Chris Turner actually said something. He wrote a piece recently for Alberta Views magazine, Calgary journalist Chris Turner, a satirical piece on the war room. And he said, like, basically forget that piece. Like, I can't top what they're actually doing. And that's how it's been, like, since day one. Like, this thing launched December. The first thing was their logo was plagiarized. Uh-huh. And so this gets called out on Twitter.
Yeah.
And the layers are crazy. You know, it's done by this ad agency that just kind of came out of nowhere within recent months. It was eventually revealed that the dog of this ad agency.
Like the house dog of the agency?
Yeah, he was like the sales dog or recruiting dog or something. Yeah. You know, he was given a pic and a bit of a bio on the website. Anyways, it was a stock photo of a dog. So just top to bottom with this thing. It's been funny. And the funny thing, too, is...
That's just heartbreaking, though, Jeremy. A second ago, that really humanized them for me, and now I don't believe in nothing.
So Tom Olson runs this thing. Tom Olson is a former Calgary Herald columnist. Mm-hmm. He covered the Alberta legislature for many years. And he went straight from his columnist gig to the Alberta government, the Conservative government, and became spokesperson for Premier Ed Stelmach. And even at that time, he was on this thing about we need to correct media. Like, media is rife with all these kinds of mistakes, and we need to be on their case, and we are a credible source that's going to, you know, set media straight. He did something similar that was just an in-house thing, part of the Alberta government, part of their website, where they would do this sort of thing. Like, something would run in the New York Times or something would run in National Geographic. And then they'd be like, no, this is wrong. And they'd kind of...
Rapid response team.
Well, that's what's new about this thing is that... So Tom Olson ran in the last election, ran for the UCP, ran for Jason Kenney's UCP, lost in Calgary, which takes some doing. And then, yeah, so now he's in charge of this thing that's billed as a rapid response war room. And when Kenney launched this, the question was like, what is the point of this, basically? And his big thing was like, this war room will be able to respond more rapidly than your conventional communications department.
Mm-hmm.
They've certainly done that. So I guess kudos to them. Did you see the Givener tweet?
I didn't see the Givener tweet. What is that?
Part of the beauty of this thing is just watching the language change. Like, any new startup, even like, yeah, I run the Sprawl. It's like you're trying to find your voice in the beginning. Like, what is the voice of this thing? And such has been the struggle of the Canadian Energy Center. So they retweeted something from Brett Wilson, our local oligarch, saying that the Teck oil sands mine would have the lowest emissions ever. And somebody calls them out on that. Andrew Leach at the University of Alberta is like, why are you guys retweeting lies? And here's what the Canadian Energy Center tweets in response. Whoops, that was done in error. I was given her this morning and got a little carried away. Sorry about that.
Wow.
So you're just kind of watching that. And then later in the day, Tom Olson tweets from his personal account, says, I apologize for some of the tweets in Canadian Energy Center Twitter thread this morning. The tone did not meet our standard for public discourse. The issue has been dealt with internally.
What are those? Our propaganda machine has certain standards, and this fell short of those.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this, though, because you're going to have perspective on this in Calgary that I do not. Reading the Times piece, as it lays out this story, because the piece covers the war room itself, and it sort of removed, you know, a 1,000-foot view down from the New York Times into Alberta. It's like there's this premier, Jason Kenney, and he has said that there's this organized effort to smear the oil sands, and he's going to fight back. And he's promised to put, like, subway advertisements and billboards in the jurisdictions, in American jurisdictions, where they're using Saudi oil, which is lower emission, but it's Saudi oil, to embarrass the local government. And just laying out facts that have become kind of familiar here in Canada, it paints a portrait of like this absolutely backwards Canadian province that is just like forthright in pushing a narrative that just seems like absolutely at odds with not just like a progressive environmentalist point of view, but where the entire economy is moving and where, you know, like policies around the world and investment around the world are moving. And this guy's just like, no, I'm digging in my heels. This is the way it is. And it's interesting to read it from that outsider perspective because it kind of puts it into stark contrast. Like, wow, I've gotten used to a really strange narrative. I wonder if that narrative is powerful in Calgary. The feeling of we are put upon and they're out to get us. Like, is that still a currency that works? And is that a message that, like...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a powerful currency, especially when you have people who, have lost their jobs at oil and gas companies. It's a very powerful currency, that there are these forces that are amassed against us. To use Kenny's verbiage, foreign-funded forces. And a lot of this is based on Vivian Krause's work.
Yeah.
Not so much the Canadian Energy Center, but the Alberta government is also having a public inquiry into foreign-funded anti-Alberta campaigns. And so the idea here is, there's all this American money coming into Canada to these environmental NGOs that are, holding up energy projects and thwarting the economy and so on.
You have to imagine that whatever comes after the oil sands for Alberta, whatever that plan is, could probably use $120 million to get it going.
Well, exactly. I can't wrap my head around that $30 million budget. I think, I have no idea where that's going. And I'm pretty sure you can't FOIP it either because of the way this is set up. It's not part of the government, per se.
Well, that dog photo wasn't free. So, Jeremy, I think people by now might have heard of this war room that your premier, Jason Kenney, has set up to fight the globalist forces trying to misinform everybody about the ethical oil that we produce in Canada. We've had enough, and Albertans have had enough, of these lies being spread by these Soros-funded... I don't know if he said that. But he feels that there's a lot of negative anti-oil stuff out there. And so he's dedicated, I think it's $120 million over 4 years. That's what the Globe and Mail says. So $30 million a year to this war room to fight anti-oil sands messaging. $30 million a year. Jeremy, you run the sprawl. You got like 900 crowdfunding supporters for your local news outfit. What's your budget per year?
I wish it was comparable to that. Let's just say that. Yeah, it's a funny situation. Taking on these foreign-funded radicals, including, most recently, the New York Times.
The New York Times. If I had $30 million to fight anti-oil sands propaganda and the New York Times ran some just scurrilous, just baseless slander of my beloved oil sands, such as this piece that recently ran, the headline was, "Global Financial Giants Swear Off Funding an Especially Dirty Fuel." So, meaning is comprised of words and global financial giants. They exist. They have sworn off funding. Yes, they have. An especially dirty fuel. Well, that's the part that I think that the worm didn't like. But I mean, it kind of is an especially dirty fuel. Anyhow, the worm didn't like that. And the war room, with their $30 million, has some pretty high-level tactics for fighting scurrilous information like that published by the New York Times. They like to kind of get down with the kids on social media and speak in kind of the vernacular of the internet. So what we had was a series of tweets from the Canadian Energy Center, which is the war room, trying to discredit the New York Times. The New York Times has had a beef with Alberta for some time now, says the Canadian Energy Center. They aren't the most dependable source. Oh, well, you're giving me food for thought there. Their track record is very dodgy, says the Canadian Energy Center of the New York Times. They have been accused of anti-Semitism countless times. Can't even count the number of times New York Times has been accused of anti-Semitism. And what else did they dig back to? They're like...
The Jason Blair scandal.
Jason Blair. Everybody remember Jason Blair? 20 years ago, there was a New York Times reporter who just made stuff up. Maybe there's a new Jason Blair.
And he wrote that article.
Maybe he wrote that article.
Exactly.
What else did they get to? They were like, the Times had like a problematic obit of Walter Cronkite that I think they very quickly and thoroughly corrected. But that was also thrown into this pile of reasons to not believe. Like, you've got the government of Alberta telling people to basically like, don't believe anything the New York Times says.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to take aim at the New York Times and go back, 15 or 20 years, I was surprised they didn't include the weapons of mass destruction, Saddam Hussein stuff. Like, I mean, that's just sitting right there.
There's a lot of problems with any news organization, even the New York Times has there's a history of corrections and problems and flaws. But, it's just sort of like an organized government. Like, let's assault truth, you know, like a source of pretty high level journalism most of the time, because it's come into conflict in stating facts about the financial divestment and the cratering of the fossil fuel market. Like, it was a factual news piece. I don't think that the War Room had anything to say calling into question any of the information in the Times piece.
No, they did do a piece after that did get into the piece. I mean, this is, the War Room is in its way a thing of beauty. It's comedy. It's pure comedy. And Chris Turner actually said something. He wrote a piece recently for Alberta Views magazine. Calgary journalist Chris Turner, a satirical piece on the War Room. And he said, like, basically forget that piece. Like, I can't top what they're actually doing. And that's how it's been, like, since day one. Like, this thing launched December. The first thing was their logo was plagiarized. And so this gets called out on Twitter.
Yeah.
And the layers are crazy. You know, it's done by this ad agency that just kind of came out of nowhere within recent months. It was eventually revealed that the dog of this ad agency,
like the house dog of the agency,
yeah, he was like the sales dog or recruiting dog or something. Yeah. You know, he was given a pic and a bit of a bio on the website. Anyways, it was a stock photo of a dog. So just top to bottom with this thing. It's been funny. And the funny thing, too, is...
That's just heartbreaking, though, Jeremy. A second ago, that really humanized them for me, and now I don't believe in nothing.
So Tom Olson runs this thing. Tom Olson is a former Calgary Herald columnist. Mm-hmm. He covered the Alberta legislature for many years. And he went straight from his columnist gig to the Alberta government, the Conservative government, and became spokesperson for Premier Ed Stelmach. And even at that time, he was on this thing about, we need to correct media. Like, media is rife with all these kinds of mistakes, and we need to be on their case, and we are a credible source that's going to, you know, set media straight. He did something similar that was just an in-house thing, part of the Alberta government, part of their website, where they would do this sort of thing. Like, something would run in the New York Times or something would run in National Geographic. And then they'd be like, no, this is wrong. And they'd kind of...
Rapid response team.
Well, that's what's new about this thing is that... So Tom Olson ran in the last election, ran for the UCP, ran for Jason Kenney's UCP, lost in Calgary, which takes some doing. And then, yeah, so now he's in charge of this thing that's billed as a rapid response war room. And when Kenny launched this, the question was like, what is the point of this, basically? And his big thing was like, this war room will be able to respond more rapidly than your conventional communications department.
Mm-hmm.
They've certainly done that. So I guess kudos to them. Did you see the Givener tweet?
I didn't see the Givener tweet. What is that?
Part of the beauty of this thing is just watching the language change. Like, any new startup, even like, yeah, I run the Sprawl. It's like you're trying to find your voice in the beginning. Like, what is the voice of this thing? And such has been the struggle of the Canadian Energy Center. So they retweeted something from Brett Wilson, our local oligarch, saying that the Teck oil sands mine would have the lowest emissions ever. And somebody calls them out on that. Andrew Leach at the University of Alberta is like, why are you guys retweeting lies? And here's what the Canadian Energy Center tweets in response. Whoops, that was done in error. I was given her this morning and got a little carried away. Sorry about that.
Wow.
So you're just kind of watching that. And then later in the day, Tom Olson tweets from his personal account, says, I apologize for some of the tweets in Canadian Energy Center Twitter thread this morning. The tone did not meet our standard for public discourse. The issue has been dealt with internally.
What are those? Our propaganda machine has certain standards, and this fell short of those.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this, though, because you're going to have perspective on this in Calgary that I do not. Reading the Times piece, as it lays out this story, because the piece covers the war room itself, and it sort of removed you know, a 1,000-foot view down from the New York Times into Alberta. It's like there's this premier, Jason Kenney, and he has said that there's this organized effort to smear the oil sands, and he's going to fight back. And he's promised to put like subway advertisements and billboards in the jurisdictions, in American jurisdictions, where they're using Saudi oil, which is lower emission, but it's Saudi oil, to embarrass the local government. And just laying out facts that have become kind of familiar here in Canada, it paints a portrait of like this absolutely backwards Canadian province that is just like forthright in pushing a narrative that just seems like absolutely at odds with not just like a progressive environmentalist point of view, but where the entire economy is moving and where, you know, like policies around the world and investment around the world are moving. And this guy's just like, no, I'm digging in my heels. This is the way it is. And it's interesting to read it from that outsider perspective because it kind of puts it into stark contrast. Like, wow, I've gotten used to a really strange narrative. I wonder if that narrative is powerful in Calgary. The feeling of you know, we are put upon and they're out to get us. Like, is that still a currency that works? And is that a message that like...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a powerful currency, especially when you have people who, you know, have lost their jobs at oil and gas companies. It's a very powerful currency, you know, that there are these forces that are amassed against us. To use Kenny's verbiage, foreign-funded forces. And a lot of this is based on Vivian Krause's work.
Yeah.
Not so much the Canadian Energy Center, but the Alberta government is also having a public inquiry into foreign-funded anti-Alberta campaigns. And so the idea here is, you know, there's all this American money coming into Canada to these environmental NGOs that are, you know, holding up energy projects and thwarting the economy and so on.
You have to imagine that whatever comes after the oil sands for Alberta, whatever that plan is, could probably use $120 million to get it going.
Well, exactly. I can't wrap my head around that $30 million budget. I think, yeah, I have no idea where that's going. And I'm pretty sure you can't FOIP it either because of the way this is set up. It's not part of the government, per se.
Well, that dog photo wasn't free. Jeremy, I want to duly note something that I think got overlooked. Without judgment, there was a lot of coverage of the death of Christy Blatchford. But as fate had it, the same day that she died of cancer, at the same hospital and on the same floor, another journalist died. And that that journalist was Ann Kingston, who I knew very briefly and on a handful of occasions she joined me in this studio, but whose work I admired for years. And a lot less was said about that. So I want to duly note it because Ann Kingston, in my limited conversations with her, made a real impression on me and just struck me as someone who approached journalism from like a really deeply human perspective and someone who sometimes went against the prevailing wisdom and trends and opinions, but not in some sort of like flame-throwing controversialist way, just because I think that's where her sense of morality took her. I'm going to play a quick clip from Anne's appearance on CanadaLand in December 2015. This is Ann Kingston discussing the disappearance of Canada's long-form census and Canada's treatment of its data.
One of the things that struck me doing the piece was, and more, it was just how normalized it has become in Canada. We talk about the libraries closing, we talk about, you know, the census, and we talk about all these things, and we sort of think it's become a norm. And it's almost as if we're inured to the consequences of it. It's a frog in, you know, slowly warming water. We don't even think about it. And that's, as I was writing this, it struck me that we're all kind of bovine on this issue, or we should be absolutely inflamed. But in order to do that, we have to get the facts. And it's very hard to get that information to begin with.
And because there's such a collection of disparate issues that you've kind of brought them all together, no one's put a name to it. Like, what is this problem?
Yeah. And that was the purpose of the piece, was to say, look, this country is vanishing before our eyes.
Jeremy, that's just the smallest bit of Ann Kingston. And I encourage people, I'm sure you have read her, whether you know you've read her or not, but why not take this opportunity to go through her body of work? It is extensive. She's a true journalist, and she will be missed. May her memory be a blessing.
Absolutely. She was a trusted writer. Like, you could always trust her stuff. Duly noted.
Jeremy, what did you bring for us today?
So I want to note an Edmonton podcast called A Tale of Two Weeklies. And it's about two alt-weekly papers in Edmonton that were rivals for, I think it was 26 years, from the 1990s onward. And this podcast series is made by three Edmontonians who had connections to those papers and are now doing a retrospective because the papers are gone. And looking back on their glory days, on the legal fights that they had, on bad blood, and I don't know, it's just a great story of a good old newspaper war. So that's my pick, A Tale of Two Weeklies.
I love that idea. You know, I mean, like, they'll be making movies and documentaries and podcast series about Biggie versus Tupac for the next 100 years. But the petty rivalries between journalists, when newspapers go defunct, all of that is lost to the ages, all of the hatred and spite, and it can be terrifically entertaining. I'm going to listen to that. Duly noted. Jeremy, I want to duly note something that I think got overlooked. Without judgment, there was a lot of coverage of the death of Christy Blatchford. But as fate had it, the same day that she died of cancer, at the same hospital and on the same floor, another journalist died, and that journalist was Ann Kingston, who I knew very briefly, and on a handful of occasions she joined me in this studio, but whose work I admired for years, and a lot less was said about that. So I want to duly note it, because Ann Kingston, in my limited conversations with her, made a real impression on me, and just struck me as someone who approached journalism from like a really deeply human perspective, and someone who sometimes went against the prevailing wisdom and trends and opinions, but not in some sort of like flame-throwing controversialist way, just because I think that's where her sense of morality took her. I'm going to play a quick clip from Anne's appearance on CanadaLand in December 2015. This is Anne Kingston discussing the disappearance of Canada's long-form census and Canada's treatment of its data.
The things that struck me doing the piece was, and more, it was just how normalized it has become in Canada. We talk about the libraries closing, we talk about, you know, the census, and we talk about all these things, and we sort of think it's become a norm. And it's almost as if we're inured to the consequences of it. It's a frog in, you know, slowly warming water. We don't even think about it. And that's, as I was writing this, it struck me that we're all kind of bovine on this issue, or we should be absolutely inflamed, but in order to do that, we have to get the facts, and it's very hard to get that information to begin with.
And because there's such a collection of disparate issues that you've kind of brought them all together, no one's put a name to it. Like, what is this problem?
Yeah, and that was the purpose of the piece, was to say, look, this country is vanishing before our eyes.
Jeremy, that's just the smallest bit of Ann Kingston, and I encourage people, if I'm sure you have read her, whether you know you've read her or not, but why not take this opportunity to go through her body of work? It is extensive. She's a true journalist, and she will be missed. May her memory be a blessing.
Absolutely. She was a trusted writer. Like, you could always trust her stuff. Duly noted.
Jeremy, what did you bring for us today?
So I want to note an Edmonton podcast called A Tale of Two Weeklies, and it's about two alt-weekly papers in Edmonton that were rivals for, I think it was 26 years, from the 1990s onward. And this podcast series is made by three Edmontonians who had connections to those papers and are now doing a retrospective because the papers are gone, and looking back on their glory days, on the legal fights that they had, on bad blood, and I don't know, it's just a great story of a good old newspaper war. So that's my pick, A Tale of Two Weeklies.
I love that idea. You know, I mean, like, they'll be making movies and documentaries and podcast series about Biggie versus Tupac for the next 100 years. But the petty rivalries between journalists, when newspapers go defunct, all of that is lost to the ages, all of the hatred and spite. And it can be terrifically entertaining. I'm going to listen to that. Duly noted.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp.
It's amazing the things that we tell ourselves to talk ourselves out of getting help. Anybody who's actually gotten help knows that the process of getting things off your chest, of taking your stressors, your problems, and just like not letting them be bottled up, working through just conveying them to somebody, half of the battle is just doing that. You unburden yourself. And you know what? If you have a real mental health professional, no, they don't have magic bullets or magic words that make it all go away. But often they can help you see things a little bit differently and guide you to strategies or tools or to a new perspective that actually does help. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Because you listen to this podcast, you get 10% off of your first month at BetterHelp.com/CanadaLand. That's BetterHelp.com/CanadaLand. This episode is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. Trust is important. There are a lot of mattress lies out there, a lot of mattress liars. And I didn't intend the pun, but it occurred to me that there is one as I was saying those words. Listen, I am not lying to you. I have experienced the Douglas mattress. It is an exceptional mattress at a surprisingly affordable price point. It is a mattress that sleeps cool, doesn't have that weird thing in the summer where the mattress gets like an oven. It's a very good product. It's delivered to your house in a box. You don't have to go to a big mattress store. It is a medium firm mattress, which is what Canadians prefer, and it comes with a 365-night trial and a 20-year warranty. What more can I tell you? Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. Jeremy, the last thing we're going to talk about today is we're going to be talking about this, I expect, in different ways and covering this in different ways for a while now. The biggest story in Canada continues to be Wet'suwet'en and the blockades, the protests across the country, the reaction to it. And here, of course, I want to talk about the media side of that. So this is by no means exhaustive because it's a fast-moving story. There's a lot going on, and I'm going to touch on a few things and want to hear what you have to say about them. I guess the first thing is that I've noticed that even as our headlines and airwaves are filled with conversation about this, with the railways closing, there's a lack of basic understanding, and people want to understand. They want to bone up on the facts, and news organizations have run many explainers. A lot of columnists have taken a try at like, okay, well, here's how it works. It's okay not to know things. We should know more about this because it's a very big deal. So when you're getting into the granular stuff about, well, like, who are the elected leaders? Who are the hereditary chiefs? Are they in conflict or do they have different jurisdictions? What's going on? Who supports this? How many people support it? I think a lot of people turn to the media just for basic information, and the media has tried to provide it with facts. But the facts in those articles are often contradictory. Robert Jago wrote a piece for us, which people should check out now on our website, is just looking at like the contradictory information that you get depending on which news source you read. So the Vancouver province, they had a piece that said that protesters have aligned themselves with five Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs who are opposed to the pipeline. Five chiefs opposed. The day before that, the Globe and Mail reported, now 9 of 13 hereditary house chiefs positions are filled by men. Okay. 4 of the positions are vacant. 8 of the 9 men oppose. So we had 5 opposing before, now we've got 8 opposing. One of the chiefs has taken a neutral position, says the Globe and Mail. You can go to the website of the Office of the Wet'suwet'en, the official organization that represents the chiefs, and they say that there are 7 chiefs, not 5, not 9, not 13. There are 7. Okay. Then you've got other stuff entering into the information stream. Like, you know, there's this word that there's another chief, Teresa Tate Day. I mentioned her last week. And she's a hereditary chief that we're told supports this pipeline in this video. And she says, you know, 85% of Wet'suwet'en people support this pipeline. And that video gets spread around by this Twitter account, Canada Action, which turns out to be this pro-pipeline Twitter account. Well, Robert Jago looks into this and says, well, she's not listed as a hereditary chief. Her status as such is at a minimum contested. And the 85% stat that she's throwing around, which has been picked up, and Jason Kenney has retweeted that, 85% of Wet'suwet'en support the pipeline, he says. Robert Jago can't find a source for that statistic, that 85% people support it. So I don't know. I guess the first thing I want to say is just like, we don't have just the basics down. Jago writes for us, listen, this isn't the case when we're reporting on other things. The number of senators in Canada, he writes, is not a matter of opinion. The number of MLAs in the BC legislature is known, as are the number of town councillors in any jurisdiction in BC or, you know, Meaford, Ontario. We know, like you know this. So the number of Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs and the number who stand in opposition to the pipeline, it should not be uncertain in the height of a national crisis and in the third year of this dispute breaking into the headlines. And that's what Robert Jago wrote for us. So maybe we could start there.
Yeah, I mean, I think we, if we're honest in the media, the Canadian media is largely white, and we are out of our element covering this story. That's just how it is. And you see that in the reporting. You see that in the commentary as well, the proliferation of takes on this whole thing. That we don't understand, yeah, not only the basics, we don't understand the issues at play here. There seems to be this idea that's prevalent, you know, this consensus view that reconciliation is something where, you know, we all just get along, so stop making all this fuss, and then, you know, Canada will be better and we'll be on our way to reconciliation. But I don't even think we know what that means. We don't know what reconciliation means. And so, yeah, I look at this and I keep thinking back to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the document that was produced out of that, the report. And that almost seems like a good starting point in terms of understanding what's at stake here and what's driving this. I just think we are very much out of our element and it shows.
Yeah, I mean, there's haziness. There's haziness as to, in practice, what does reconciliation mean? In practice, what does nation to nation mean? There's no haziness among certain voices in this. Like, you know, there's a voice that whatever you might say about it, it's got a consistent position. And that is this this voice saying that this is illegal and all the land is Canada and basically just challenging the legitimacy of any Indigenous leadership. And challenging the rights of any of the protesters to be doing what they're doing and basically saying, you know, let's go crack some heads. Let's shut this down. I find that a deplorable position, and it's at odds actually with the law internationally and Canadian. But it is the legacy of Canada, like it's people who are representing what it's always been. And into the vacuum of really not understanding or knowing what is like, OK, we all want to get along. But when we have a conflict, who wins? You know, it's one thing to not know the facts. It's another thing to default to this position that it's all illegitimate.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to bring up something that I'm very uncomfortable bringing up. And I think that I have in the most, you know, straightforward way, a conflict of interest when it comes to discussing the last episode of the Sunday edition, Michael Enright's show. You know, listeners of the show know that he was an important person to me professionally and personally. And it's hard when somebody, you know, to criticize them. And, you know, every decision is like a recusal or a disclosure. And I think probably this is like a recusal. Like, I don't think that I'm somebody who can criticize Michael Enright because I care for him so much and I respect him as a journalist. And like, I can't help but remember that, like, when even the idea when I was very young of Indigenous issues to me was something that was sort of like buried in Canada's past and not something I thought I had to think about. The first person in my life who said to me, like, this is happening right now. It's not right. There is this thing called the Indian Act, and it's deplorable and needs to be torn up. That person was Michael Enright. So, you know, that's going to lead me to have a certain kind of bias in discussing what happened this past week. I can't excuse what happened on his show because I think he started from a position of curiosity in trying to understand just these basic facts, what's going on and who speaks for these people and who speaks for the land. And he had on Grand Chief Stuart Phillip, the president of the Union of BC Indian Chiefs, on his show. And I think that it was an interesting test case where I will give him a generosity that some people won't, and thinking that I do think he set out with an intention of understanding and listening. But somehow, and this is like a metaphor for what happens on a larger scale, something about not knowing and wanting to be informed, but then there's like, I don't know, a laziness or a rush to jump to conclusions and almost just this feeling of certainty of like, well, if they're going to walk away from the talks, then to hell with this kind of a, like as the interview proceeds, it feels like I'm willing to understand this only up to a certain point at which the conflict might be unresolvable. I don't know. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but there was a conclusion of that that I'm talking about this all right now because I think I can't ignore it on the show when we're talking about the coverage of what Sowetan. And this is how that interview ended.
Let me, before we run out of time, let me ask you about the long-term impact of the dispute in terms of the Crown Indigenous relations in Canada. Where do you think this is going to go?
Well, you know, as I said on the steps of the legislature, reconciliation cannot be achieved at gunpoint. And we cannot achieve reconciliation by throwing matriarchs and elders and children in jail. We cannot achieve reconciliation by choppering in paramilitary RCMP forces in full battle gear, surrounding encampments. You know, it was absolutely shades of Vietnam what happened up in Wet'suwet'en territory. So,
well, hang on a second. Vietnam, were they napalming your people?
You weren't there.
No,
I can tell you. I can tell you if choppers started landing in your backyard and teams of heavily armed police started running through your front yard and dragging you out of your homes and so on and forth, now you'd be a little upset.
Chief, thank you. Thank you for joining us. It's good to talk to you.
So, yeah, I don't know what I can say about that. I think Grand Chief Stuart Phillip, I think, made an excellent point there in the face of, I think, you know, kind of an arrogant posture there. And I think I think that for Michael, it's sort of like the boomer thing of like if you touch certain cultural touch points of, oh, you're going to mention Vietnam. For other people, it's mentioning the Holocaust. Like, don't compare it. Like, there's something sacred about these certain historical events. And the Grand Chief there, I think, made an excellent point. Like, what do you, like, does it have to get to napalm? If there's choppers coming into your land and people are taking away your people and cops in military gear, yeah, I'm going to make that analogy. And there was just a shortness of temper and I don't know.
And then the interview's over.
And that's the other thing. Like, I've produced that show and there's always the ability to ask another question and try to take it a little bit further. But it did feel like that was kind of hustled to its conclusion. That's all I have to say about that, I guess.
That goes to show the gap between the Canadian media and what we're covering here. There's a gap in experience, in knowledge. And so, yeah, it comes out in interviews like that, where it's like, certainly that's not something Michael Enright has ever experienced, right? Whereas, yeah, for a lot of Indigenous people, that is the experience of living in fear and being under attack in myriad ways. And I totally agree with what you said about, you know, there's these historical events that I don't know if we lift them and put them aside. It's almost like we lift our own era out of history. Like it's this default view that, you know, we're here. This is how it is. And this is the fact that you have to live with, like that this settler society is here and dominant and calls the shots, and it'll be that way, you know, till kingdom come. And what's happening with this fight is that that's really being challenged, that narrative. And I think, yeah, mainstream Canadian society is profoundly uncomfortable with that.
Yeah. The last piece I want to talk about is another CBC piece by Jorge Barrera, who is a journalist who's been covering Indigenous issues for some time, somebody who was a reporter for APTN, now for CBC Indigenous. And I think over the years has done some terrific reporting and has built up a lot of goodwill with different Indigenous communities across the country, which I think that reputation and that relationship was challenged with this story that he ran, where what happened was, of course, we've got these protests along the rail tracks across this country, and Jorge was covering the Mohawk protest here in Ontario. The piece is titled Inside the Meeting Between Mohawk and Canada's Indigenous Services Minister. So Mark Miller, the Indigenous Services Minister, he met with Mohawk protesters and Mohawk leadership in Ontario to try to talk them into letting trains pass through their blockade. And what happened was there was a private meeting in which media was not welcome. And somebody recorded it and gave Jorge Barrera a copy of that recording. And he based his story on that recording. And the response to that from Indigenous Voices has been very critical. This was brought to my attention by Ryan McMahon, and I asked him to share some thoughts on the piece. Here's what he had to say.
the response to Jorge's article, I think, is an appropriate one on the ground with Indigenous folks. They're skeptical. They don't trust the media. There's a clip circulating around right now where Molly Wickham at a fundraiser is talking about the need for Indigenous-created media to provide nuance and context and complexity around the stories and the issues. And it's being used as propaganda against the Wet'suwet'en. And Molly's point is simply that, you know, we need to ensure that the messaging is accurate and strong and comes from an Indigenous understanding. And what has happened here with Jorge's story, you know, while factually these things are true, certainly in the room we see the reactions of many people that were actually in the room. A young man by the name of Jordan Brandt, who created a Twitter thread that got a lot of traction, and a Facebook post from Christy Belcourt, who was also in the room, that said, in fact, this reporter did not get it right. This reporter probably misread a lot of these facts and is guilty of inflaming the incident. And already at an incident where things are very, very dicey minute by minute, even second by second at that point, having somebody publish something that has been leaked out of a meeting where they were meeting in good faith, probably not the most helpful thing in the world.
So, Jeremy, there are three problems people had with Jorge's piece. The first is that he had this recording at all and that it was disrespectful for him to publish what was supposed to be a private meeting. I want to talk about that later, but that's the first problem that a lot of people had. The second is that because he wasn't there, the story is misleading. The story, basically, it says that they were kind of like hashing out maybe a de-escalation where the Mohawk protesters might actually allow the trains to function again. But then there was a call from a hereditary chief, Chief Woos, and that call, it is suggested in this piece, really shut down any chance of a de-escalation or any kind of negotiation. And people who were there say that's not what happened. The protesters were not going to step aside, regardless of that phone call. And if you had been in that room, you would have known that. And the third thing that was pointed out about the piece by Jordan Brandt, who Ryan mentioned there, is that there are these kind of cliches and characterizations that arise from the piece. I'll go direct here. Barrera writes, some were saying they were witnessing the start of an Indigenous uprising and revolution. Barrera goes back and reminds us that the Mohawks of Tayendanaga have shut down the 401, one of Canada's busiest highways, and the CN tracks in the past. And he ends the piece with this description of red Mohawk warrior flags flapping from the raised level rail crossing as masked young men wearing camouflage occasionally gazed through binoculars at the OPP cruisers up the road. And we see pictures of these Mohawk protesters in their military, you know, camouflage with masks on their face and conjuring up confrontations in the past. And I think that that is leading people nowhere but with thoughts of, wow, I'm terrified. You know, these are, you know, angry masked Mohawks in military gear. You know, be afraid. I think that's the part that was most egregious to me from a completely different perspective. I think that the point that you like, you know, Barrera was up front. I wasn't at this meeting. This is from a recording. But he does present it in a way that strongly suggests this phone call was really a turning point in what happened. And other people say that's not the case. I guess I don't know. To the first point, Jeremy, that Jorge should not have published a story based on a leaked recording to begin with, I kind of have a problem with that. I feel like reporters, like, yeah, like everybody wants to have, if they can, when they're trying to negotiate from a very tense standoff, negotiations in private. And when it's a matter of incredible public interest, this is the biggest story in the country. If I got a secret recording of one of those meetings, you better believe I'd report on that. Would you?
So that's a good question. Given the subject matter, I don't know, to be honest. In this case, where there's trust that's so fragile already between Indigenous people and the media, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't know if I would run it. I would have to think long and hard about it.
Yeah, I try to listen like openly to discussions about how there are different cultures of storytelling and representation. And I think that you have to, I think if you're touching these issues or covering them, take into consideration the history of misrepresentation. But the idea that it's a reporter's job to think about and protect the sensitivities of a relationship, that's not the job. The job is to report on what's going on. But it's also not the job to inflame things and to kind of amp things up. And I do think that Jorge's piece did that in a couple of different ways.
I mean, this kind of goes back to Christy Blatchford in a way. Like, one of the things after she died, so obviously her coverage of Indigenous issues, I would describe as abysmal. But one of the things that she would tell young reporters was that, you know, write what you write and don't give a fuck what other people think. And there's an element of truth to that, right? That you need that fearlessness as a journalist. But I don't know. I think there's like a whole other element that we do have to take into account, which is relationships. It's weird. I don't know. It's a weird tension. It's a weird tension.
Yeah.
Between like, yeah, sure, you get information, you put it out there, you expose what is hidden, all that stuff. But I kind of look at it and I'm like, no, you actually do need to think about what your reporting will do. And I think there's increasingly a recognition of that.
Well, I haven't been as quick to damn Christy Blatchford outright as some have, because I do think there's something instructive and useful and essential to the craft and the practice of saying, my job is to get the facts and report them. And if I get too concerned about whether or not you're going to like me or what's going to happen because I report these facts, the outcome I'm not responsible for. I'm not responsible for, you know, conferring sympathy to one party or the other. I'm responsible for the truth.
Mm-hmm.
That is sort of an essential ethic of reporting. Mm-hmm. But I think that when you look at some of the accounts that have come out after the couple of days when, you know, I think, you know, something like 7 out of 10 articles on the front page of the National Post were hagiography glorifications of Christy Blatchford, not even mentioning this stuff. Other accounts started to trickle out, like Glenn Caning, Rattaya Parsons' father, about the impact on his life of her reporting and the things that she overlooked because she thought she had the truth. Or things like our own news editor, Jonathan Goldsby, just remarking that, you know, Christy Blatchford had this remarkable platform. And increasingly towards the end, there was something that set her off about vulnerable people. Whether it was the victims.
Yeah, like boys hugging.
Yeah, yeah. Men she felt were effeminate, Indigenous people who she felt were playing the victims, sexual assault victims. You know, I think that there's a lesson there too, which is that you might think you're just telling the truth and letting the facts lie, but you might have second thoughts about what the full truth is. And some of the things that Glenn Caning shared were reportable matters of fact that belonged in Christy Blatchford's reporting about Rattaya Parsons.
It's responsible journalism to wrestle with that, to wrestle with what will my reporting do? And especially when you're reporting on people in groups that are marginalized. And yeah, I don't know. The best I can come up with is you have to hold those two things in tension somehow. You're fighting for the truth. You're fighting to get information out there, but not carelessly. There's an obligation to wrestle with that to some degree.
Okay, that's your Canada Land Shortcuts. Jeremy, thank you for talking with me today.
Yeah, thanks, Jesse.
Listen, it's never been easier to support the work that we do here and to get ad-free versions of the show. If you go to your show notes, episode notes, it's just like the first link. You click it and in 2 minutes, there'll be a gold-plated premium podcast feed. Like it'll just bloop, put the ad-free feed of Canada Land onto your podcast app and you'll be giving us $5 Canadian a month. So check that out or just go to canadalandshow.com/join. You can email me about what you heard today at jesse@canadalandshow.com. I do read everything that you send me. We're on Twitter at Canada Land. Jeremy, where can people find you and your news organization?
So the Sprawl is at sprawlcalgary.com and Sprawl Calgary on all the social media platforms.
Our website, canadalandshow.com, is where you're going to find the piece I was talking about earlier by Robert Jago, which is titled The Reporting Gap in the Wet'suwet'en Crisis. It's a must read. This episode is produced by David Crosby. Our managing editor is Kevin Sexton. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Jeremy, the last thing we're going to talk about today is we're going to be talking about this, I expect, in different ways and covering this in different ways for a while now. The biggest story in Canada continues to be Wet'suwet'en and the blockades, the protests across the country, the reaction to it. And here, of course, I want to talk about the media side of that. So this is by no means exhaustive because it's a fast-moving story. There's a lot going on, and I'm going to touch on a few things and want to hear what you have to say about them. I guess the first thing is that I've noticed that even as our headlines and airwaves are filled with conversation about this, with the railways closing, there's a lack of basic understanding, and people want to understand. They want to bone up on the facts, and news organizations have run many explainers. A lot of columnists have taken a try at, like, okay, well, here's how it works. It's okay not to know things. We should know more about this because it's a very big deal. So when you're getting into the granular stuff about, well, like, who are the elected leaders? Who are the hereditary chiefs? Are they in conflict or do they have different jurisdictions? What's going on? Who supports this? How many people support it? I think a lot of people turn to the media just for basic information, and the media has tried to provide it with facts. But the facts in those articles are often contradictory. Robert Jago wrote a piece for us, which people should check out now on our website, is just looking at, like, the contradictory information that you get depending on which news source you read. So the Vancouver province, they had a piece that said that protesters have aligned themselves with five Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs who are opposed to the pipeline. Five chiefs opposed. The day before that, the Globe and Mail reported, now 9 of 13 hereditary house chiefs positions are filled by men. Okay. 4 of the positions are vacant. 8 of the 9 men oppose. So we had 5 opposing before. Now we've got 8 opposing. One of the chiefs has taken a neutral position, says the Globe and Mail. You can go to the website of the Office of the Wet'suwet'en, the official organization that represents the chiefs, and they say that there are 7 chiefs, not 5, not 9, not 13. There are 7. Okay. Then you've got other stuff entering into the information stream. Like, you know, there's this word that there's another chief, Teresa Tate Day. I mentioned her last week. And she's a hereditary chief that we're told supports this pipeline in this video. And she says, you know, 85% of Wet'suwet'en people support this pipeline. And that video gets spread around by this Twitter account, Canada Action, which turns out to be this pro-pipeline Twitter account. Well, Robert Jago looks into this and says, well, she's not listed as a hereditary chief. Her status as such is, at a minimum, contested. And the 85% stat that she's throwing around, which has been picked up, and Jason Kenney has retweeted that, 85% of Wet'suwet'en support the pipeline, he says. Robert Jago can't find a source for that statistic, that 85% people support it. So, I don't know. I guess the first thing I want to say is just, like, we don't have just the basics down. Jago writes for us, listen, this isn't the case when we're reporting on other things. The number of senators in Canada, he writes, is not a matter of opinion. The number of MLAs in the BC legislature is known, as are the number of town councillors in any jurisdiction in BC, or, you know, Meaford, Ontario. We know, like you know this. So the number of Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs and the number who stand in opposition to the pipeline, it should not be uncertain in the height of a national crisis and in the third year of this dispute breaking into the headlines. And that's what Robert Jago wrote for us. So maybe we could start there.
Yeah, I mean, I think we, if we're honest in the media, the Canadian media is largely white, and we are out of our element covering this story. That's just how it is. And you see that in the reporting, you see that in the commentary as well, the proliferation of takes on this whole thing, that we don't understand, yeah, not only the basics, we don't understand the issues at play here. There seems to be this idea that's prevalent, you know, this consensus view that reconciliation is something where, you know, we all just get along, so stop making all this fuss, and then, you know, Canada will be better and we'll be on our way to reconciliation. But I don't even think we know what that means. We don't know what reconciliation means. And so, yeah, I look at this and I keep thinking back to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the document that was produced out of that, the report. And that almost seems like a good starting point in terms of understanding what's at stake here and what's driving this. I just think we are very much out of our element, and it shows.
Yeah, I mean, there's haziness. There's haziness as to, in practice, what does reconciliation mean? In practice, what does nation to nation mean? There's no haziness among certain voices in this. Like, you know, there's a voice that whatever you might say about it, it's got a consistent position. And that is this this voice saying that this is illegal and all the land is Canada, and basically just challenging the legitimacy of any Indigenous leadership, and challenging the rights of any of the protesters to be doing what they're doing, and basically saying, you know, let's go crack some heads. Let's shut this down. I find that a deplorable position, and it's at odds actually with the law internationally and Canadian. But it is the legacy of Canada, like it's people who are representing what it's always been. And into the vacuum of really not understanding or knowing what is, like, okay, we all want to get along, but when we have a conflict, who wins? You know, it's one thing to not know the facts. It's another thing to default to this position that it's all illegitimate.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to bring up something that I'm very uncomfortable bringing up. And I think that I have, in the most, you know, straightforward way, a conflict of interest when it comes to discussing the last episode of the Sunday edition, Michael Enright's show. You know, listeners of the show know that he was an important person to me professionally and personally. And it's hard when somebody you know to criticize them. And, you know, every decision is like a recusal or a disclosure. And I think probably this is like a recusal. Like, I don't think that I'm somebody who can criticize Michael Enright because I care for him so much and I respect him as a journalist. And like, I can't help but remember that, like, when even the idea, when I was very young, of Indigenous issues to me was something that was sort of like buried in Canada's past and not something I thought I had to think about. The first person in my life who said to me, like, this is happening right now. It's not right. There is this thing called the Indian Act, and it's deplorable and needs to be torn up. That person was Michael Enright. So, you know, that's going to lead me to have a certain kind of bias in discussing what happened this past week. I can't excuse what happened on his show because I think he started from a position of curiosity in trying to understand just these basic facts, what's going on and who speaks for these people and who speaks for the land. And he had on Grand Chief Stuart Phillip, the president of the Union of BC Indian Chiefs, on his show. And I think that it was an interesting test case where I will give him a generosity that some people won't, and thinking that I do think he set out with an intention of understanding and listening. But somehow, and this is like a metaphor for what happens in a larger scale, something about not knowing and wanting to be informed, but then there's like, I don't know, a laziness or a rush to jump to conclusions, and almost just this feeling of certainty of like, well, if they're going to walk away from the talks, then to hell with this, kind of a, like, as the interview proceeds, it feels like I'm willing to understand this only up to a certain point at which the conflict might be unresolvable. I don't know. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but there was a conclusion of that that I'm talking about this all right now because I think I can't ignore it on the show when we're talking about the coverage of Wet'suwet'en. And this is how that interview ended.
Let me, before we run out of time, let me ask you about the long-term impact of the dispute in terms of the Crown Indigenous relations in Canada. Where do you think this is going to go?
Well, you know, as I said on the steps of the legislature, reconciliation cannot be achieved at gunpoint. And we cannot achieve reconciliation by throwing matriarchs and elders and children in jail. We cannot achieve reconciliation by choppering in paramilitary RCMP forces in full battle gear, surrounding encampments. You know, it was absolutely shades of Vietnam what happened up in Wet'suwet'en territory. So,
well, hang on a second. Vietnam, were they napalming your people?
You weren't there.
No,
I can tell you if choppers started landing in your backyard and teams of heavily armed police started running through your front yard and dragging you out of your homes and so on and forth, now you'd be a little upset.
Chief, thank you. Thank you for joining us. It's good to talk to you.
So, yeah, I don't know what I can say about that. I think Grand Chief Stuart Phillip, I think, made an excellent point there in the face of, I think, you know, kind of an arrogant posture there. And I think I think that for Michael, it's sort of like the boomer thing of like, if you touch certain cultural touch points of, oh, you're going to mention Vietnam. For other people, it's mentioning the Holocaust. Like, don't compare it. Like, there's something sacred about these certain historical events. And the Grand Chief there, I think, made an excellent point. Like, what do you, like, does it have to get to napalm? If there's choppers coming into your land and people are taking away your people and cops in military gear, yeah, I'm going to make that analogy. And there was just a shortness of temper and I don't know.
And then the interview's over.
And that's the other thing. Like, I've produced that show and there's always the ability to ask another question and try to take it a little bit further. But it did feel like that was kind of hustled to its conclusion. That's all I have to say about that, I guess.
That goes to show the gap between the Canadian media and what we're covering here. There's a gap in experience, in knowledge. And so, yeah, it comes out in interviews like that, where it's like, certainly that's not something Michael Enright has ever experienced, right? Whereas, yeah, for a lot of Indigenous people, that is the experience of living in fear and being under attack in myriad ways. And I totally agree with what you said about, you know, there's these historical events that I don't know if we lift them and put them aside. It's almost like we lift our own era out of history. Like it's this default view that, you know, we're here, this is how it is, and this is the fact that you have to live with, like that this settler society is here and dominant and calls the shots, and it'll be that way, you know, till kingdom come. And what's happening with this fight is that that's really being challenged, that narrative. And I think, yeah, mainstream Canadian society is profoundly uncomfortable with that.
Yeah. The last piece I want to talk about is another CBC piece by Jorge Barrera, who is a journalist who's been covering Indigenous issues for some time, somebody who was a reporter for APTN, now for CBC Indigenous. And I think over the years has done some terrific reporting and has built up a lot of goodwill with different Indigenous communities across the country, which I think that reputation and that relationship was challenged with this story that he ran, where what happened was, of course, we've got these protests along the rail tracks across this country, and Jorge was covering the Mohawk protest here in Ontario. The piece is titled Inside the Meeting Between Mohawk and Canada's Indigenous Services Minister. So Mark Miller, the Indigenous Services Minister, he met with Mohawk protesters and Mohawk leadership in Ontario to try to talk them into letting trains pass through their blockade. And what happened was there was a private meeting in which media was not welcome. And somebody recorded it and gave Jorge Barrera a copy of that recording. And he based his story on that recording. And the response to that from Indigenous Voices has been very critical. This was brought to my attention by Ryan McMahon, and I asked him to share some thoughts on the piece. Here's what he had to say.
The response to Jorge's article, I think, is an appropriate one on the ground with Indigenous folks. They're skeptical. They don't trust the media. There's a clip circulating around right now where Molly Wickham at a fundraiser is talking about the need for Indigenous-created media to provide nuance and context and complexity around the stories and the issues. And it's being used as propaganda against the Wet'suwet'en. And Molly's point is simply that, you know, we need to ensure that the messaging is accurate and strong and comes from an Indigenous understanding. And what has happened here with Jorge's story, you know, while factually these things are true, certainly in the room we see the reactions of many people that were actually in the room. A young man by the name of Jordan Brandt, who created a Twitter thread that got a lot of traction, and a Facebook post from Christy Belcourt, who was also in the room, that said, in fact, this reporter did not get it right. This reporter probably misread a lot of these facts and is guilty of inflaming the incident. And already at an incident where things are very, very dicey minute by minute, even second by second at that point, having somebody publish something that has been leaked out of a meeting where they were meeting in good faith, probably not the most helpful thing in the world.
So, Jeremy, there are three problems people had with Jorge's piece. The first is that he had this recording at all and that it was disrespectful for him to publish what was supposed to be a private meeting. I want to talk about that later, but that's the first problem that a lot of people had. The second is that because he wasn't there, the story is misleading. And the story, basically, it says that they were kind of like hashing out maybe a de-escalation where the Mohawk protesters might actually allow the trains to function again. But then there was a call from a hereditary chief, Chief Woos. And that call, it is suggested in this piece, really shut down any chance of a de-escalation or any kind of negotiation. And people who were there say that's not what happened. The protesters were not going to step aside, regardless of that phone call. And if you had been in that room, you would have known that. And the third thing that was pointed out about the piece by Jordan Brandt, who Ryan mentioned there, is that there are these kind of cliches and characterizations that arise from the piece. I'll go direct here. Barrera writes, some were saying they were witnessing the start of an indigenous uprising and revolution. Barrera goes back and reminds us that the Mohawks of Tayendanaga have shut down the 401, one of Canada's busiest highways, and the CN tracks in the past. And he ends the piece with this description of red Mohawk warrior flags flapping from the raised level rail crossing as masked young men wearing camouflage occasionally gazed through binoculars at the OPP cruisers up the road. And we see pictures of these Mohawk protesters in their military, you know, camouflage with masks on their face and conjuring up confrontations in the past. And I think that that is leading people nowhere but with thoughts of, wow, I'm terrified. You know, these are, you know, angry masked Mohawks in military gear. You know, be afraid. I think that's the part that was most egregious to me from a completely different perspective. I think that the point that you like, you know, Barrera was up front. I wasn't at this meeting. This is from a recording. But he does present it in a way that strongly suggests this phone call was really a turning point in what happened. And other people say that's not the case. I guess I don't know. To the first point, Jeremy, that Jorge should not have published a story based on a leaked recording to begin with. I kind of have a problem with that. I feel like reporters, like, yeah, like everybody wants to have, if they can, when they're trying to negotiate from a very tense standoff, negotiations in private. And when it's a matter of incredible public interest, this is the biggest story in the country. If I got a secret recording of one of those meetings, you better believe I'd report on that. Would you?
So that's a good question. Given the subject matter, I don't know, to be honest. In this case, where there's trust that's so fragile already between Indigenous people and the media, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't know if I would run it. I would have to think long and hard about it.
Yeah, I try to listen like openly to discussions about how there are different cultures of storytelling and representation. And I think that you have to, I think if you're touching these issues or covering them, take into consideration the history of misrepresentation. But the idea that it's a reporter's job to think about and protect the sensitivities of a relationship, that's not the job. The job is to report on what's going on. But it's also not the job to inflame things and to kind of amp things up. And I do think that Jorge's piece did that in a couple of different ways.
I mean, this kind of goes back to Christy Blatchford in a way. Like one of the things after she died. So obviously her coverage of Indigenous issues, I would describe as abysmal. But one of the things that she would tell young reporters was that, you know, write what you write and don't give a fuck what other people think. And there's an element of truth to that, right? That you need that fearlessness as a journalist. But I don't know. I think there's like a whole other element that we do have to take into account, which is relationships. It's weird. I don't know. It's a weird tension. It's a weird tension.
Yeah.
Between like, yeah, sure, you get information, you put it out there, you expose what is hidden, all that stuff. But I kind of look at it and I'm like, no, you actually do need to think about what your reporting will do. And I think there's increasingly a recognition of that.
Well, I haven't been as quick to damn Christy Blatchford outright as some have, because I do think there's something instructive and useful and essential to the craft and the practice of saying, my job is to get the facts and report them. And if I get too concerned about whether or not you're going to like me or what's going to happen because I report these facts, the outcome I'm not responsible for. I'm not responsible for, you know, conferring sympathy to one party or the other. I'm responsible for the truth.
Mm-hmm.
That is sort of an essential ethic of reporting. Mm-hmm. But I think that when you look at some of the accounts that have come out after the couple of days when, you know, I think, you know, something like 7 out of 10 articles on the front page of the National Post were hagiography glorifications of Christy Blatchford, not even mentioning this stuff. Other accounts started to trickle out, like Glenn Caning, Rotea Parsons' father, about the impact on his life of her reporting and the things that she overlooked because she thought she had the truth. Or things like our own news editor, Jonathan Goldsby, just remarking that, you know, Christy Blatchford had this remarkable platform. And increasingly towards the end, there was something that set her off about vulnerable people, whether it was the victims.
Yeah, like boys hugging.
Yeah, yeah. Men she felt were effeminate, indigenous people who she felt were playing the victims, sexual assault victims. You know, I think that there's a lesson there, too, which is that you might think you're just telling the truth and letting the facts lie, but you might have second thoughts about what the full truth is. And some of the things that Glenn Caning shared were reportable matters of fact that belonged in Christy Blatchford's reporting about Rehtaeh Parsons.
It's responsible journalism to wrestle with that. To wrestle with what will my reporting do? And especially when you're reporting on people in groups that are marginalized. And yeah, I don't know. The best I can come up with is you have to hold those two things in tension somehow. You're fighting for the truth. You're fighting to get information out there, but not carelessly. There's an obligation to wrestle with that to some degree.
Okay, that's your Canada Land Shortcuts. Jeremy, thank you for talking with me today.
Yeah, thanks, Jesse.
Listen, it's never been easier to support the work that we do here and to get ad-free versions of the show. If you go to your show notes, episode notes, it's just like the first link. You click it and in 2 minutes, there'll be a gold-plated premium podcast feed. Like it'll just bloop, put the ad-free feed of Canada Land onto your podcast app and you'll be giving us $5 Canadian a month. So check that out or just go to canadalandshow.com/join. You can email me about what you heard today at jesse@canadalandshow.com. I do read everything that you send me. We're on Twitter at Canada Land. Jeremy, where can people find you and your news organization?
So the Sprawl is at sprawlcalgary.com and Sprawl Calgary on all the social media platforms.
Our website, canadalandshow.com, is where you're going to find the piece I was talking about earlier by Robert Jago, which is titled The Reporting Gap in the Wet'suwet'en Crisis. It's a must read. This episode is produced by David Crosby. Our managing editor is Kevin Sexton. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures, and it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you.
A couple of years ago, a cop was shot dead on a deserted pier in the tiny nation of Belize. The only other person there that night was a frightened young woman found covered in blood. By all appearances, it was an open and shut case. But not in Belize, where this woman was connected to a mysterious billionaire who basically runs the place.
Justice will not be served in this case. She's going to get away with it.
Or will she? White Devil, a Campside Media original. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.